This is the Catford Speaks, our podcast for our White Sox blog, The Catford Seat. It is available on iTunes. Just to get that out of the way. Obviously, you've already found it if you're listening at this point, but search for The Catbird Speaks on iTunes, subscribe to it, and you probably won't have to go through whatever rigmarole you went through to find it this time. Joining me today from Manhattan is the birthday boy, Nick Schaefer.
Hey, hey.
He is now...
It was me and Joe Morgan yesterday.
Same age, I believe, right?
Yeah, and very similar resumes.
Yeah, I mean, you were a shortstop, but...
Yeah, I mean, and his bat was a little bit better than mine, but I like to think I made up for it with my glove.
I mean, you have more playoff bona fides, though.
Yeah, he was a choke artist.
Yeah.
He's no Nick Schaefer in the clutch, gotta say.
There were years where he didn't make the playoffs, and it just makes you think less of him. We were in the dog days of September White Sox baseball. These are just some of the sleepiest White Sox games you ever want to see, and they're like less than 8 games out of the playoffs, but just with utterly no shot.
And a lot of the playoff races have kind of, I would say the National League East and American League East playoff races resolved so quickly and suddenly and like thoroughly. I mean, I guess it's technically they're not over yet, but that leaves basically the AL West and I guess the second wild card at this point is all that's really left.
The second wild card is like in the AL is the worst race I can imagine because it's just like this clearly better Astros team and a bunch of like really mediocre 500-ish teams just waiting for the Astros to completely collapse all the way down to them. Even though the Astros have like a plus 90 run differential.
Yeah, they did win. They won again today, so they've started. They've won two in a row. They're starting to maybe they're stabilizing a little bit. But yeah, they're plus 92. Yankees are plus 81, and then the rest of the AL is beneath there is pretty dodgy. At this point, the only real rooting interest I have is making sure is the Twins not getting in because they just drive me crazy. And if the White Sox like gifted them a playoff berth, I'd be very irritated.
Kind of same for the Indians. I don't know, I guess I predicted them, but they've also just like been so bad.
Yeah,
them crawling in would be really weird.
I predicted the Indians to win the division. I think did the entire staff predict them to win the division?
Most.
Yeah. So there is that sort of sense of.
I feel like anyone picked the Royals. One of us might have picked the Tigers.
Yeah, I mean so I wouldn't really mind. I wouldn't really mind Cleveland sneaking in there. But yes, to your point, it's the dog days of September. The White Sox are going through the motions, I guess.
Yeah. I just think it's, you know, it's bad to regularly submit your fans to like 1 month out of six is just pointless, lifeless baseball. Well,
it's been a lot of that this year, frankly. It's troubling that there are. It's like, you know, I grew up with a lot of seasons where September was meaningless. I think all White Sox fans are pretty used to this. Most years, the team is not in contention into September. I mean, I've seen people point to 2012 like it was this incredible year, and they won what, like 85 games and missed the playoffs. So, like, but people were thrilled just that they were like hung around to the end.
I mean, they were in the division lead for, if not,
yeah, most of the year,
like
yeah,
the majority than the plurality of the year.
I know. I also, while we're talking about the 2012 team, I've heard people say like, well, Ventura was like perfect for that team because it was like a veteran laden team that they just needed somebody to keep things calm. I'd argue that they didn't stay calm down the stretch, evidently, because they played poorly. But also, you'd think that if it's a veteran clubhouse where they've all been familiar with each other and been there for a while, you don't really need to pick managers for their personality. You'd think that you'd want them to get the strategy right, which is the opposite of what they did. So anyway, that I've heard that conversation and it kind of bothers me because I think people interpret it backwards.
I just wonder how much credit you can get for personality management for a team that like not only like choked down the stretch of the season, but literally like choked in the sense like they couldn't hit with runners in scoring position and everything else was fine. But like actual like high leverage opportunities, their hitters fell apart.
Right, but it's also like that roster didn't need somebody to like a teacher or a guy to keep them calm in their first days in pro ball. I mean, that team was ancient.
Yeah.
You know, like Canerco didn't need somebody like a steadying hand.
Well, he needed somebody who never had.
He needed somebody who wasn't going to bunt with Euclid.
Jesus, that memory.
I'm not forgetting that. I think Ventura should have just like fired on the spot for that and been like, "Oh no, you have no idea. You're vastly underqualified." But yeah, so we're here in this meeting of September. But growing up, like I said, used to this is the default is September is just playing out the string. But usually, there's like this time of year, you're looking at like the young players for next year, right? Like that's the cool part of this season, or that's what you pay attention to.
That and stat collection, I'm like so used to just like rooting for people to meet round numbers. I just found myself like slipping into rooting for Jose Abreu to get 100 RBIs just out of like reflex.
Yeah, I did that. You know, obviously when like Frank Thomas was pretty much the only thing the team had, I was just rooting for him to like have the most massive numbers possible. Abreu, I guess, is the equivalent for this team, hoping for him to get to 30 dingers, hoping for him to get his OPS above 900. Sale, and we'll get into this more later, doesn't have the shiny ERA to root for. But there's really not – what's depressing is how little there is by way of young dudes like up and coming for next year for a team that's been – this is year three of the rebuild, right?
Year three of the rebuild or year one of the competitive window.
Right. Either way.
We didn't really know that 2013 was part of the rebuild until we got into it.
It was thrust upon them.
And then they started it during the deadline.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like they started 2013 with like a bunch of like, they're going to take their lumps projects. It was more like Jake Peavy and...
Oops,
we brought Canerco back.
Right. It's funny too that one of the legacies of this era or this just past era was so much of them going like all in was just them re-signing the same dudes. It was just like extending the same guys. Like that's what their biggest moves were. Be like, Brzezinski's still here. It's like, okay, so it's the same team as last year, basically. All right.
Like, we're bringing Adam Dunn in. It's like, oh, you're replacing Canerco because he's old? No, we're resigning Canerco.
Yeah. So there's the bright spots, I guess, for next year. Trace Thompson's kind of – we were talking about this a little bit before recording. I'd like to cover some of that ground again and move forward from there. You know, fortunately, Trace Thompson didn't miss much time with his elbow tweak. Not nearly as much as I thought he would when I saw it.
That was not the most graceful thing I've ever seen.
So he faced a righty today. Apparently, one of the best pitchers of all time, Josh Tomlin.
Yeah. And a ringing double and struck out twice.
Yeah. And I think yesterday he had a couple of walks off of, was that Carrasco yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, he looked bad against Carrasco, but Carrasco also looked like he was going to throw a perfect game after three innings. So everyone looked bad.
Right. So we were talking about, you and Ethan and I got into a conversation on Twitter. The conclusion seemed to be, so my point was largely, look, he's better than Abascal at this point. Just because, like, the gap between their gloves is already huge. And then, frankly, like, once you're there, Thompson doesn't really need to hit all that much. And it's not clear to me that he won't hit better than Abascal anyway. But in terms of where that leaves the position and whether you can use him as an everyday player and say that you're trying to compete, what were your thoughts on that?
You could, in the sense that you have, like, four like bleeding holes in your lineup and mm-hmm. it's understandable you won't fix all of them and at least some of them have to just do the best you can with the org depth you have and hope you like get above replacement level.
Right.
But in terms of looking at the free agent market, right field is probably the easiest place to get a fix in terms of money. And money is still probably what the Sox have because this is an organization that really is not very good depth-wise. So a kind of major trade for an impact player is always... It's still hard for them to pull off, even if that's like the better way to get someone younger or on the better side of their production curve than, you know, signing Melky Cabrera and Adam LaRoche.
Right.
So, like, there's right. solutions like... Suspedes is probably, you know, exorbitantly expensive, but there is a... And so is Hayward. But, you know, maybe you just have to pay money once in a while. And Justin Upton.
Yeah. And it's... I mean, Hayward's going on a hot streak with the bat recently as well, over the last few months. And he's looking... It looks like he and Suspedes have moved ahead of Upton in terms of what they're going to get this offseason.
Yeah.
Just based on sort of the buzz. I mean, obviously, Suspedes is... played out of his mind since he got traded to the Mets, and Hayward's been rebuilding his. He's interesting because he's flashed all kinds of different tools at the plate, but he hasn't really had extended periods of time where he's done all of them at once. You know, like his on base skill, his hitting for contact, and hitting for power. And I know he's had some injuries in the past, but I saw like 150 mil thrown out there for Hayward as like what people think he's going to get, and Suspedes is sort of starting the bidding at 6 years for him. And Suspedes, I believe, is quite a bit older than Hayward.
I think Hayward is like
26.
Hayward is 26.
Oh, and Suspedes is 30,
or he's going to be 30.
Yeah. So, ages 31 to 36 is what that would be.
Yeah.
I mean, Suspedes is awesome, and he's super cool, and he'd be a huge upgrade for the White Sox. I'm terrified of, like, even if they did sign him, I'd be, like, really scared of that, because he's one of those, he doesn't really control the zone much. He's, you know, a contact and power guy. No real walks, and those kind of guys haven't really, I don't know, the White Sox don't do well getting the most out of that profile.
He's listed here as having a... on this free agent list, the Alex Gordon is listed as having a 12.5 player option. Though I haven't really heard about him being a free agent with any kind of excited talk. I mean, part of that could be that he's 32, or part of that is just he sounds like he's going back to the Royals.
Yeah, I don't know if it's not a mutual option, right? It's just a straight player option. Yeah, it looks like. Yeah, I don't know. Do you think he would exercise it?
I just feel like he could get more.
Yeah, I think it'd be crazy for him to exercise it because you're just pushing another year past your prime to try to get in free agency. I mean, there's no way a team wouldn't at least offer him like $13 million or whatever. You know what I mean? Like he could get more for next year at least, let alone moving forward.
There's also options like Dexter Fowler. I suppose Colby Rasmus isn't really that interesting. So he'd be an upgrade.
You'd think that if they were going to do Colby Rasmus, they would have already done it.
What do you mean?
Like, you know, like they would have done it last offseason.
Right.
But maybe not. I mean, I guess if they were this, like last offseason, it was still, you know, we hadn't had another 500 plate appearances of Abascal being awful at that point. You know, Abascal still hadn't really played a full season, so you could still argue, like, hey, maybe he's good.
I mean, even, like, the first 2 months of this year, I was still kind of optimistic for him. I mean, when he was singling everything all over the place, there was always a chance he could just do that forever.
I'm trying to remember who else was up there. It was, like, Abascal and somebody else were, like, I think it was, like, him and, like, Iglesias were, like, competing for the batting title for a little bit in May. Something like that.
What a time to be alive.
Yeah. Iglesias is still hanging out at 300.
What if he's
just a better bat than Abascal as like an elite glove at short?
I don't know what's funny about this, Nick.
Laugh or cry, James. Those are your choices.
It's suppose so. Yeah, Trace, he's without a doubt the most interesting guy probably to watch hit, short of like Abreu or Eaton, like obvious choices. Like,
right.
Someone that we're going to learn about in the lineup every day. Like, Trace Thompson's probably your answer. And he's, you know, doing very well. The walk rate, the number of walks he's getting is, you know, very livable. He's showing great pull power, which is like, I don't know. It's something I guess you would expect from him. But after watching Avisail and Diane Viciado and just like hoping they would hit the ball left field, like it's something he does very easily.
Right.
He's very good at, you know, turning inside fastballs.
Dude can run.
He can run. He can actually, you don't worry about him defending his position. You just don't worry about like him seeping away value from like every other orifice. But this is a guy whose prospect sheen was pretty much gone. And you know, for good reason. He just kind of languished in AA and AAA, putting up really mediocre numbers for a while. Yeah. Everyone said like his hit tool has never really come together. At the time, promotion, the MLB.com prospect list, which is not like the greatest source for information, but it had Thompson as number 14 in the organization, behind like Courtney Hawkins and Chris Beck.
I've never understood the Chris Beck thing, which is I've never understood his appeal.
It's not that he's highly rated. He's just like the most, he's like the best pitcher on the Charlotte Knights.
Right. But even going back further, I think he's had an injury that in between him and a once upon a time illustrious sort of profile. But going back to Trace, yeah, his performance is just like, I know that the stats don't tell the whole story, especially for minor leaguers. But like, I'm trying to remember the last time he had 75 plate appearances like this in the minors. Like, this just feels like such a gigantic outlier. I am encouraged that his K percentage hasn't been crazy. He's at 23% coming into today, and I guess that may have went up a touch today. But you know, he was sitting in the high 20s, mid to high 20s for K percentage all throughout the minors, and you know, obviously one doesn't necessarily expect that to improve as you face harder pitching in the majors. So that's a real concern. And you know, the White Sox don't have a great track record of getting swing and miss guys to tone that down, and certainly not as they transition in the major leagues. So it's weird. It's like really weird that he's even had this nice 75 plate. Like, this feels wrong. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not used to White Sox minor leaguers coming up and doing things like this.
The thing that kind of lost at upper levels is while he was able to cut down his Ks, it kind of sapped away from like his raw power really playing in games. And really, he didn't really consistently get his raw power to play in games as much as he's gotten so far, really at any point, AA or above.
Yeah, I'm looking at his stat sheet now from the minors, and it's he's been around forever. It's easy to forget that he's still only 24, because you know, he's been in the system, and he and Carlos Sanchez for a long time were like the only two position players in the system, like at all. If you remember, like 3 or 4 years ago, it's like they were like top five in the organization prospects.
Thompson being just like a really raw high school tool bag was like a really, he really stood out in the White Sox system when he debuted.
Right. And I mean, like, that's the thing too. You watch him and the athleticism is like definitely there. It's not, I kept hearing about how Avisail is, you know, tools, 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 tools. But you look at him and he's like a plotter. Like, I don't really see, he doesn't seem like super coordinated or anything. You know what I mean? Like, the athleticism, like Trace like oozes athleticism. That's not the case with Avisail at all. So it's nice that the toolsy outfield prospect, like one of them, at least one of them looks like he's a freaking 24-year-old athlete and not like, you know, a beer league softball player.
Avisail's like athleticism, it's fitting that it shines at robbing home runs, because it allows him to like not have to do everything at once. Like, run to the wall, stop, turn around, stop, jump really high. Now you're at the highest point, extend your glove. And like, It's very, yeah, that's, like...
That's a really good
everything's
point.
Everything's compartmentalized. But, like, coordinating, like, lots of things at once, he doesn't look as graceful.
Yeah, do, like, one task at a time. Yeah.
Like, reading that's a very... where the ball's going while backpedaling, while feeling for the ball, like, all that at once doesn't go well.
Yeah. So, you know, like, I don't know if I'm prepared to project. Like, okay, let's say they just threw Trace out there for, he got 600 plate appearances and he starts like 140 games in right field next year. What his line would look like. Cause there is room for these guys to like, it's not impossible for these types of guys to improve in their mid 20s. Cause they're like super raw toolsy athletes. Like that's kind of the hope. But I'm just not sure he's going to be able to make enough contact to be a starter.
Yeah, but it's funny, like, him and Obstel are the same age.
Mm-hmm.
He's older. So I feel like we're committing the sin of assuming a guy that we just are seeing for the first time is not as far along in his development or has more upside than he would be than Obstel.
Yeah, and you have to, and this is something that generally speaking, people, you know, I got so frustrated with Viciado, and it's, I guess, the conversation with Abbasale too, where somebody keeps saying, but he's young, like he'll get better. And as we saw with Viciado, that's not necessarily the case because you need to identify what you think that they have the ability to get better at. Like, you know, when I was 22, I wouldn't have gotten better just because I was young at baseball. You know what I mean? Like, if I was in the major, it would have just been, like, a disaster. Like, what skill would I possess that you would think, like, oh, no, he hasn't, like, fully tapped into that yet. So Abbasale, like, has demonstrated, like, I don't know what skill he's going to, I guess his power, maybe. Like, maybe he could just keep hitting, low on base percentage, 260. But, like, if he ever figured out how to pull something, you know, I guess maybe you get more of that like a Milwaukee Chris Davis type player, which is still better than what Abbasale is.
Yeah,
but it's not,
I mean, at this point Abbasale knows what they want him to do. It's like being spoken out in the public by Robin more and more and in a less and less like forgiving way.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that's clearly what the upside would be, is that he's got, like, this phenomenal raw strength, and if he ever, like, actually lofted the ball, his, like, home run per fly ball rate would probably be pretty impressive.
Right.
But it's a question of whether or not you see anything in, like, his ability to, like, put it into work. And I kind of don't, because I don't think he can actually cover that side of the plate where pitches to drive to left field come to him. Like, there's just so much work that needs to be done, and just there's no real sign of progress on it.
Yeah.
So that makes me more curious about Trace and being able to put his raw power to use.
It's you know, we're talking about, I almost feel dishonest having this conversation as he's in the middle of like an aberrant hot streak.
Because yeah.
You know, but at the same time, like you said, he's shown skills that Abbasale like hasn't. Like he's shown pull power on like a variety of different types of pitches.
So like from a purely like aggressive standpoint, I think neither one is good enough, and they're going to have a hard enough time cobbling together like a good offense or even a passable one. Out of what they got, and they need to be aggressive and take the opportunity to get one of the right fielders we talked about or make some sort of other deal because to put a big plus bat in right field, because I'm even like harder pressed to find who they're going to find to fix their third base situation,
which for sure
is just historically awful. But as we were talking before the show, I think it's probably confusing for a casual fan, because you have this guy who the Stone and Hawk talk about, Trace Thompson, like he's this very like promising prospect. They speak like very glowingly about him, about like he's got this like top pedigree, his entire family is athletes, and he's going to be a great ball player. And if he comes up for like a month and a half and just mashes, you're probably really confused why the team like spends $150 million to like block him from playing time.
Yeah.
But so as much as we feel like we shouldn't rag on the announcers because they're just like speaking to the casual fan and, you know, there's no point in just like being negative and you're supposed to be kind of like providing entertaining product. I feel like they're really misleading people about Trace Thompson.
Yeah. I mean, the nice thing about Thompson is that because he can play center, you know, like there's a role for him, even, you know, like he has a very obvious, nice bench profile.
He should be on the team.
And I like
J.B. Shuck, and he's had a good year, but I'd rather have Trace Thompson.
Yeah, and, you know, and you can't necessarily say the same thing about Abbasale, but at the same time, also by that same token, in terms of the structure of the team as a whole, like, the argument for Trace Thompson's starter is his glove is great and he'll do enough with the bat where, like, he's above replacement by dint of his glove, right? But the problem is you're starting to do that now at, like, every freaking position because it's like, all right, well, Carlos Sanchez, he's there for his glove, and, like, Saladino, he's there for his glove, and Flowers, he's there for his glove. And, yeah, like, you know, you can't – if you're going to have a couple of spots where – you know, like a lineup should be healthy enough to be able to carry a couple defensive, like players who get their value from the glove, especially positions like catcher or shortstop. But like, you can't do it everywhere. And what's funny too is, and I don't know how much of this is residual from, you know, I guess Abbasale or from, you know, whatever you think of Adam Eaton, or but like the defensive metrics are all freaking terrible for the team too. So it's fascinating that they're like, somehow 50% of the lineup is as defensive specialists and the defense is still bad. So like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah. I mean, part of that is Fangraphs hates Eaton's defense for whatever reason.
Mm.
I don't think they don't seem to be that interested in Tyler Saladino suffering through that for the glove because they picked up Mike Olt on waivers and basically made him an everyday player since. And Mike Olt is real bad.
Yeah, and, you know, I applaud them for still trying things. I really do. I even if it's Olt, and he's had some pretty frustrating errors, and he just, you know, he's never going to be able to put his bat on the ball enough to be a viable major leaguer, I don't think. But at least, like...
it's a worthwhile September's pursuit. It's really depressing that they have to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, they're trying, but... the odds of success are so slim.
But then, like, at the same time, you're beating your head against the wall with Tyler Saladino. You know that can't work. He doesn't, like, have the bat to profile as, like, an everyday middle infielder. Like, he was a utility guy when he came up. Like, he doesn't have a chance at third base.
No. No, and there's only, like I said, there's only so many places you can just, like, punt on the offense entirely. Like, we've seen it. You know, this offense has basically been, like, one or two dudes for like the whole year. And even, you know, like even if you had somebody like Bryce Harper, who's just like this insane offensive force, like Joey Votto, who's getting on base like 45% of the time, those guys still have 0-for-4s. Like, what are you doing then? What are you doing on those games?
So I think as I was referring to the four awful positions, or at least four. One of that would be DH.
Yeah.
So, and they're paying that guy a lot of money. And I probably think, like, with his age and with the way his strikeout rate just exploded this year,
mm-hmm.
that he's probably looking more towards, like, done than slumping. I mean, there could be a dead cat bounce next year, but you probably, if anything, want to strictly platoon him with a right-hander, maybe someone like Trace.
Right.
You could conceivably get like a big right fielder to kind of put him in some sort of rotating DH situation with your four outfielders, with Trace included, and, you know, make Adam LaRoche intensely situational.
Right. Yeah, I mean, for me, if I'm the White Sox, like if I were in charge of the White Sox, you know, I'd make finding a big right fielder priority one for this offseason, and I'd be willing to spend in free agency to do it. If other players have taken some of the luster, you know, distracted away from Justin Upton, like, fine, great. Like, sign me up. I'd love to have Justin Upton here. And his defense is, I think Justin Upton's defense has diminished quite a bit in the last few years, is what I feel like has been the, accepted wisdom at this point. Because I know when he was first came up, like, he was pretty solid and right, but I think
could you mitigate that at all by switching him from larger parks like Atlanta and San Diego to Chicago?
Could very well be. That could be a big part of it. And, you know, like you said, the rotating DH thing sounds
Where you could just not
great.
Play him as much.
Yeah, just, you know, like have Trace cover for him in late innings when you're up, or have him DH a decent amount of the time. That's why Trace is like, you know, if you need a home run and the like, they've got a lefty out there, or they've got a lefty out on, like, as a reliever, just like, yeah, you can pinch it. There were so many games early this year where they just had nobody to pinch hit for LaRoche for it, and it was so weird. It was so weird that they couldn't find anything like that instead. So that totally makes sense to me.
Shuck has reverse splits that Robin has been pretty much unwilling to acknowledge all year.
Uh-huh.
Like, he's basically like Lee average versus lefties and bad versus righties.
I think it's cool that, I think Shuck is a cool player. I think he's like he's definitely one of the success stories of the year, but he's obviously, you know, like an on-base defense speed guy. He's not a power source, and this team like desperately needs power wherever they can get it.
I'm glad that we have given J.B. Shuck an opportunity where he will get a job next year, is how I feel about him.
Yeah. No, he's like, he definitely, you know, he had that great year in, was it 2013?
He had a good year in 2013.
Well, for a guy who can play center, like, I don't know, seven, I guess it's, he's got no power.
like, this is his upside. Like, he has delivered the best version of J.P. Shuck we could have hoped for, and it's a good bench player, but it's not something you should rearrange around.
No, but he'll get a major league pension, I hope. Like, he'll get enough service time for that.
I'm trying to find the report, but Mal Rubio sent me a link to something about the Pirates are probably going to non-tender or release Neil Walker.
Really?
And I found it. So my inclination would be just like, you're probably stuck with Carlos Sanchez at second, just because finding a second baseman who can like hit the ball out of the infield is just too hard. But there's that.
Yeah, I mean, he's 30.
Who else? At Struble Cabrera, I probably want to sign up for that. No. Daniel Murphy is 31. He's coming available, and the Mets have no money at all, so...
Juan Uribe, I don't know if you'd want to run him out there at second anymore.
He just like violently face planted himself tonight and needed like 5 minutes afterwards. But
I guess he and like, which is while we're on the Mets, he and like Kelly Johnson are probably floating around. Yeah, I mean, Neil Walker would be tremendous. That's surprising. I guess it makes sense if they have Gong and Mercer and Harrison and, you know, all these guys.
Kang's late. You don't know when he's going to be back.
Yeah, he just got his knee destroyed, so.
And Mercer can't hit at all. Mercer would have a hard time getting playing time here.
I haven't checked in on him in a bit.
He's got a 60 winner run created.
Oh, yeah. That's he's a Southsider.
Like, that's sub Carlos Sanchez for the year, probably, at this point.
Sure. But why do you think that would be? That it would be for money reasons?
That's what it sounds like.
How are they still broke?
I don't know.
How many, like, 90-plus win seasons do they have to have in that gorgeous park before, like, they can, like... Really?
It's Rob Bierpfenthal of the Pittsburgh Tribune-Review reports that Pirates are likely to non-tender or trade second baseman Neil Walker this offseason. He'll be entering his third and final year of arbitration eligibility after earning $8 million in 2015. He's played in 138 games, but has been bothered by lower back issues, which...
Oh, God.
He has a 270, 332, 426 triple slash line, which, for adjusted for league and park factors, is a step down from his output the previous three seasons. So that's your mitigating factor.
I mean, I love that. And this all goes back to, like, you know, when you look around at the options at third and second, which are the other places you're, like, you know, really hoping you can get a, you'd have to be able to improve. Because, like, if you're running sub 600 OPS is out there at third base again next year, like, I just don't know how this, like, this team doesn't have the surplus talent elsewhere to overcome that. And we've seen that. There's just too many black holes in the lineup. But those spots are hard to improve. And so it really puts the pressure on right field to get some production there. And that's where, you know, like, if you sign Justin Upton, like, that is a difference maker for your team. As opposed to, I don't know, I mean, maybe a declining, aging Neil Walker. I mean, he's definitely a big upgrade on what they have now, but...
I mean, he's 30. I mean, I have some hope that Herm could help keep him healthy. I mean, Paul Konerko was more cortisone man his last, like, couple seasons.
Yeah,
excuse me. And I guess that may be the... Maybe that's the thing with LaRoche, too. Like, obviously, he's ancient and... has a bunch of injuries and all that. Maybe you're just hoping that, you know, an off season of rest, like, you can just, maybe he's just not healthy and you doubt he ever will be, like, fully healthy.
He basically hasn't played the last 2 weeks because of a knee issue.
Yeah. Maybe the hope is you just, you know, an off season of rest, he's an only facing right-handers. You get something useful out of him as opposed to nothing. But that's the all you have left. I mean, you can't really, obviously you can't trade him for anything. I guess you could just cut him and just pay him, what, $15 million to go away?
$15 million, yeah. Be a little hard.
So.
I don't know if you were around for my Twitter questionnaire earlier today.
No, I don't think I was.
But what was the last season the White Sox got 700 OPS or above? From the third base position.
Ooh.
No one has got this right all day.
Is it 2008?
Too cynical.
What am I missing?
What would be your second guess?
Uh, 2010?
That's correct. The committee of 43-year-old Omar Vizquel, Mark Tian, and the rookie debuts of Dion Vecchietto and Brent Morrell made up a, I think I had it, it was a 7-11 OPS.
Jeez. If you'd told me those names, though, I would not have guessed that that would be the one that cracked.
Vecchietto was really good. He had like an 800 OPS and like 100 right. PAs.
Right.
Yeah, so 7-11 OPS.
Jeez.
Morrell was like 680s. Mark Tien was like barely above 700, but above 700. And Vizquel was like solidly middle 700s while he was playing third base, but bad overall.
Oh, woof. Jeez.
A lot of people guessed the Euclid year, which is hilarious because that was the worst one.
Oh, yeah. No, that's the thing. Is like Euclid came in and like stopped the bleeding to an extent, but... Oh my God. Like, are people, I don't blame people if they like completely blocked out what came before him.
He not only like only played half the year and like had like a middle 700 OPS when like Hudson and Morrell were like sub 600, but his knee was bothering him down the stretch. He would have to take a day off or two every like once a week and Hudson would play some more.
Yeah. But his, I mean, like he had the third highest on base on the team.
Yeah. It's really freakish how they missed having 700 last year since their primary third baseman, Connor Gillespie, had a 750 OPS. But for some reason, Gillespie only had like a 730 while he was playing third. And Marcus Semien,
like
who was like 670 for the year, was 560 while he was playing third. And then the kicker was 40 PAs of Lurie, which was like freaking poison.
Right, and whatever like Gordon Beckham pitched in too, I'm sure.
Beckham did not play third last year.
Oh, really?
He's not listed as having any third base appearances.
Is Gordon Beckham just, by the way, does he get even, he's what, gets like a couple minor league non-roster invites, and then does he even like crack a major league roster next year?
I think he probably like tunes up AAA pitching and someone gets hurt for some.
I guess like Clint Barmas is still hanging around, so.
Clint Barmas is a better defender than Gordon Beckham. Yeah,
no, that's true.
And has like a lot more shortstop experience.
He might be a better bat too.
But yeah, I don't. That's, he did a lot to shorten his career this year.
Clint Barmas had a, what was it, that rookie year stretch? I mean, I miss like the steroid era, and I miss like Coors Field stats from the steroid era are the freaking best, man. Because he hit 320 over his really small sample size. His OPS plus was 87. Like, that's incredible. Now I want to just like Google like 1996 Rockies stuff, but I won't do that too. I know it's great radio, but Eric Young as a second baseman 1996 for the Rockies, 324, 393, 421 for a 98 OPS plus.
393.
Second base, incredible. In terms of moving forward, but like where are you going to devote the resources? Because I've seen people say like, okay, well. You know, the White Sox were really interested in re-signing Jeff Samardzija before this season. I think you may have heard it hasn't gone as they'd hoped.
He sucks. I hate him.
He's terrible. He makes grilled cheese in the microwave. But you know, if people thought, well, they had room for one big contract this offseason, they had a tab for Samardzija. I mean, I'd be blown away if that happened now. I just don't see how you could like sell that to your fans. I just don't.
Blown away is an interesting word to use.
Well, because he doesn't do that anymore. But
I don't know. Like, I've seen people fucking saying infuriated like, might be able
after that last start where he gave up what 10 or 11 runs, whatever the hell it was. People were saying, "Wow, you can't even like, you can't offer him the qualifying offer now. Like, it's too risky. Like, what if he says yes? There's no way. There's no way he says yes. First of all, for all the personal reasons that and like his he feels duty bound to explore free agency and max it out and understand. Like, that's easily the coolest thing about Jeff Samardzija at this point.
Possibly the only thing.
Yeah, I mean that's like really awesome of him to be keeping his colleagues." In mind like that. But
it's good that both Heyman and Rosenthal kind of asked around about this and both got it to like, yeah, he'll still be worth it for him to go to free agency.
So you have to give him the offer because you need that. I mean, like, you have to take the draft pick. But even if he did accept the qualifying offer, that's not like I would hate it because I'm just so sick of him being on the team and I just hate watching him play. But from like a baseball, from, you know, a rational perspective, it's probably, it would still be good value. Like, you'd be fine with that. Like, a 1 year deal is so hard to screw up. 1 year deals are great.
I don't know. If you had like another 520 ERA season, that'd be kind of screwed up.
Be unfortunate. Definitely be unfortunate. But
200 really shitty innings. Thanks.
Oh, what's the deal with, like, so let's say they give him, let's say if he accepted the qualifying offers, just for hypothetically, and then next year free agency rolls around, can they offer him a qualifying offer again? And if he declines, they still get a draft pick, like, again?
I think so.
Right? Like, that doesn't go away just because you're already coming off a qualifying offer, I wouldn't think. But no, they're actually looking like, you know, as of with a loss today, they moved into 10th. They now have the 10th draft pick alone. Boston won, and if they got a top 10 protected pick and a comp pick for Samardzija at the end of the first round, you could sign a huge free agent and still have like two picks in the top 40. I think.
Yeah, Carlos Rodon and Spencer Adams all over again, right?
Yeah.
That's how it works.
Yeah, exactly.
You get two more.
I don't see how they can sign a pitcher. I know people are worried about, you know, like Smarja is a whole bunch. They're crappy innings, but there's still a lot of them. And Danks is crappy innings, but there's still a lot of them.
Not as many.
Danks?
Yeah, Danks is a lot of crappy innings. Smarja is like a league leading number of crappy innings.
Yeah, no, he's like what's it, like a workhorse, but he like spreads disease in the village or something like that. Like, I don't know. What.
Like 220 horrible innings.
Yeah. But I'm not so worried about their rotation because you look at what they're good at, first of all. They're good at developing pitches. They're bad at developing hitters. They have Sale, Quintana, and Rodon for next year. Rodon's looking great. I think that, you know, there's risk there, but if you at a certain point, especially if you don't have like the Dodgers resources or some of these other organizations like competence, relying on a guy like Rodon as like a key part of your rotation is that might just be something you have to do if you want to have a chance at competing, right? Like if you're like dumping resources into hedging against Rodon maybe failing, then like you don't have the resources to do that. Does that make sense?
They have not lived a charm enough life for Rodon to be their wild card. He's got to be like their number three.
Yeah, exactly. Like if
preferably better.
Yeah, and I mean, geez, Eric Johnson freaks me out. But I think that they can figure out like the back end of the rotation. Like all their best prospects are like, still arms, except for Tim Anderson, and he's not somebody you take into consideration for next year.
I hope not.
No, you have
Eric Johnson conceptually freaks me out. Visually, he bores me.
I think that you can afford to. I don't think you need to acquire a starting pitcher. I think you can deal with it. I think you can deal with the rotation completely internally next year if you have to.
You have to. You have too many offensive holes.
Right? Thank you. All right. So, James, you're hired in my front office.
All right. Do I have to take like a huge salary like cut to like because I'm supposed to be honored to be working in baseball?
Yeah, I mean it's for your, you know, it gets your name out there. All right. You should be thanking me for
going back to TV news now.
So Sale had another stinker.
7 innings, 1 earned run.
Right. Just what a weird season for him.
Yeah, I'm really interested in what the postmortem is going to be.
I do. So this is something I've been thinking about in terms of the hidden costs of having a terrible offense, where, you know, people talk a lot about stress pitches versus, you know, it's not just how many pitches did they throw, but like what were the circumstances. And I heard, I think Mark Mulder was talking about this against on Jonah Carey's podcast where, and, you know, player anecdotes, take them for what you will. But he sort of confirmed this where he's like, look, there were days where I'd be just gassed by 100 pitches because I was just like in a jam constantly. And I was like having to stay mentally and physically like perfect the entire game. And it was exhausting. Whereas there were days where I'd throw like a complete game shutout on like 120 pitches. And just like, I felt like I could have pitched all day just because it wasn't taxing at all. Like there was no, I wasn't being challenged at all. So if you take that as true, given that the White Sox are so, their offense has been so bad, I'm wondering if there's that cumulative effect of like every pitch is a stress pitch on the White Sox, because if you give up a run ever, that like that might be it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I kind of feel like that might be the same deal with Robertson.
Yeah, you're just like, you're just never able to coast. Like you're never given a healthy lead. You're never given like a 3-4 run lead to like just, you know, you don't have to go. And we've seen, you know, you can see it with Sale. Like he has the breadth of velocity where you can tell when he's like dialing it up because he can, and when he's not. So I feel like we've seen a lot more heat from him this year and a lot more strikeouts. But I do wonder if he's like going max effort at all times because he knows that the only way he can win is if he goes 8 shutout innings.
Yeah, that could be part of it. And I just feel like he hasn't had the command, and I don't know. Is that fully explained by that?
If he's feeling fatigue and trying to be too fine with all of his pitches, maybe.
I mean, it seems like, if anything, he's come out of the gate feeling like that a lot. Possibly, like, I mean, a prominent example is he'd come out a lot of games this season just, like, throwing 99 or even, like, touching 100, but, like, not being able to throw the strike zone and not really looking his best until he calmed down and started throwing 95, 96.
Right.
Where he just, like, is coming into the situation too amped up, even for his own good.
I'd love to see... They have cluster luck for teams. I don't know. I haven't found it for individual players. I do wonder if Sale's getting... Because he's had so many just, like, big innings, specifically. And it feels like he has given up, you know, a lot of home runs for him. But I do wonder how much of it may just be that, like, the hits he's allowing are clumping together.
I'm trying to remember where I heard it, but I think it was over the radio, so it might have been Ed Farmer. But they were talking about Don Cooper was saying that he specifically thought that the Twins had picked up some way that he was tipping his pitches.
Mm-hmm.
And that was explaining, like, the huge rallies they're having off him.
I mean, maybe. It people try to explain, you know, oh, well, why are the Twins of all people just, like, hitting him so well and nobody else is? And that would, you know, if that is true, that might explain it. But obviously I can't comment on that. That's my alternate theory is just, you know, the residual effect of zero run support ever. And I wonder what the cumulative effect of that too. Like, that's got to have a lot of cascading effects all over the place. Like, starting pitchers are going deeper against you than they would against other teams, and you're never getting into, like, the crappier relievers for your opponents because you're always behind, and, like, so you're always facing, like, two innings of their best relievers instead of getting their starter out in the fifth or the sixth. So, I do think that all that's going to add up, because now you have, like, okay, not only is our offense bad enough and that's why we're in this situation in the first place, but then, you know, they're also now going up against only the other team's best relievers and so on and so forth.
This is Chris Sale's, like, best F4 year ever.
Mm-hmm.
And possibly his worst real season. It's definitely his highest ERA. It's definitely the most I've seen him and thought he doesn't look right.
Well, we talked about the defense being...
But again, like, my standards for his performance have risen a lot since 2012.
The defense has been bad. You know, we've seen it. And it's been, at least whatever measurements we have for it, seem to agree. And... He's also being left in to throw. I mean, he could just be tired. I mean, he gets left in to throw a ton of pitches.
I mean, he's not working some marginal level innings.
Isn't he, like, first in pitcher abuse points?
I don't check it regularly, but I assume so.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't have a great answer for you. Those are some suggestions for, like, possible contributing factors.
I just feel like we're going to get something interesting at some point, either in the offseason or at Sox Fest or at spring training, where he's just going to say, like, oh, my leg was bothering me the whole time. Or this was screwed up this whole time.
Maybe.
Because answers he's giving are very just like, oh, I got to pitch better. It's like very, then they're not checking if he's hurt. There's no, like, reports of, like, MRIs. It's just like something's wrong that they're not talking about.
But, I mean, his FIP is, like, the best in the league. I know FIP's not everything, but maybe we're just overreacting.
Chance.
Yeah. So I would love Justin Upton. Is that a good note to close on?
Yeah. I mean, he'd be better than Gerardo Parra.
What about Alejandro De Aza?
I can't like come up with like a real reason like why he'd be terrible. I mean, we know who he is. I feel like it's just like familiarity breeding contempt.
No, that's exactly it. Because I'm like, it's such a White Sox move to like bring back this one of the same guys who's been on these teams that have just like been so like underwhelming and boring.
Like if he just came like wearing a mustache and his name was like Califrando De Paza, and if you're like, oh my god, he's hitting so much better than Abisail.
Yeah,
he crushes like, right-handers. This is amazing.
Yeah, he's like, you know, he's got good bat speed, and the guy can run a little bit.
Like, well, he doesn't run routes good enough to cover center, but he's really fast. He steals some bases.
Yeah. Eaton's stolen base improvement's a cool development from this season. I think he's 15 for 21 or something like that.
Yeah, after getting caught today, he's 15 for 21.
Yeah. See, going out on a positive. What was it? What was it? Califrando De Paza? Is that what you?
Yes.
That's my new favorite player. That might be my. I might have to change my name on Twitter to that. Really obscure. Yeah. Happy Sunday. White Sox jockeying for draft position. A couple. You know, Montas has been fun to watch. So there's some stuff happening.
They've totally screwed up starting him for whatever reason.
I wouldn't be surprised if they want him to just have a, like, this is his, they're putting him in a position to succeed in his cup of coffee here, and they'll.
This is true. All right, listen to the situation. I need to tell you about this, because I know you probably weren't following it. Chris Sale was originally scheduled to start Wednesday.
Yep.
Ventura has said that, first, like, Hawk said, like, on the broadcast today, Chris Sale is going to start Wednesday, but now it's been put on the back burner. And that's all he said. So, like, seven innings, I'm just, like, wondering what the hell's wrong with him.
Mm-hmm.
Then, like, at the end of the game, Dan Hayes posts an article saying that Ventura wants to possibly push back Sale a day if he can, but needs the next three starters to eat up enough innings to where he doesn't have to use Scott Carroll or Frankie Montas. So that they could, like, eat, like, the Wednesday game, and they can, like, have Sale get, like, a regular full 5 days, I guess, instead of having to deal with the doubleheader
situation.
But he pitched Montas for an inning today. So, like, Montas can't pitch Wednesday. He's not going to be ready for that. So then you're pitching Scott Carroll, and if you were picking between Montas and Scott Carroll to give, like, a throwaway September start, why would you not pick Montas? And Scott Carroll was only called up to the roster after they had freaking Alexi Ramirez and Lourdes García pitching a game. And like, holy crap, why didn't we carry more pitchers during freaking September? Scott Carroll, who season just ended, and they didn't call him up at all. And he went home and was playing catch at his house for a week.
And they're clearly...
And that's going to start.
I think it's irresponsible for them to be carrying Daniel Webb instead of Scott Carroll. I think we saw why.
But they could just carry both.
Yeah, September. I don't know.
Good for Scott Carroll. He's a good guy, but why?
I got nothing for you, man. They're dumb.
Like, if things you'd rather see, just like for entertainment purposes, and also like for finding out about your guys' purposes, like Frankie Montas throwing like five innings. What? Who cares what Scott Carroll can do? Yes, he can do that, probably. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I think that they're, after they're, you know, had to lean on their bullpen so heavily and it got so ugly, I think they're probably, maybe they're just gun shy. Maybe it's like, okay, well, Carroll we know can, like, muddle through and Montas might get knocked out in the second and then, you know.
Then you can put Carroll!
Then you can put Alexi back in, I guess. I don't know. But we'll find out.
Montas will look great, so that's our positive ending.
Absolutely. And have a good night, Mr. DePaza.
Thank you, Mr. Califrando.
See you, man.
See ya.